Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm your host, Hannah Colton, news director and reporter here at KUNM. Police violence takes many forms, and some communities in Albuquerque experience it much more than others. Since last Thursday, Black Lives Matter protesters have been out nightly in Albuquerque calling for justice for George Floyd and others killed by police and pushing for an end to racist policing. This morning, we're digging into how law enforcement is responding to protests here, and we consider the question of who and what do police seem to be out to protect during this time of unrest. How do you see law enforcement operating in your community? What needs to happen to end racist police violence in New Mexico? Give us a call this morning, 277-5866. You can also email letstalk@kunm.org, and we'll get your comment or question on the air. First up, I want to welcome to the show Marisa DeMarco, a KUNM reporter who spent many years covering criminal justice. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Marisa, you've been out covering several of these Black Lives Matter protests in the past week. What was last night like?
You know, last night and also the night before was really just hundreds of people marching and chanting and carrying signs. Last night they went to Civic Plaza, where they delivered speeches. They also stopped in front of City Hall to speak. The night before, they stopped in front of the police station and the sheriff's office station downtown. But these two actions were really focused on the march and on the message. Last night, we were hearing, again, reports of militia folks walking around with guns. But then last night we weren't hearing that at all. So there's a shift going on somehow.
And why is it so important to you that we as reporters are eyewitnessing what goes on at these events? You know, especially late into the night and keeping an eye on police and sort of vigilante types like you just mentioned.
Yeah. So, you know, on Sunday night, after thousands of people demonstrated, then there at the hours later after that had ended, there was, you know, 100 people maybe left downtown, and then a handful of them were smashing windows. But because there was not a lot of news media out there at that time, it got reported incorrectly in the morning that, like, this thousands of person demonstration had erupted in violence, I think, or erupted in riot. And that's just really misleading. It's just not at all what happened. So it's really important that we get out there and see with our own eyes what's happening, especially when what's coming out of the police department the next day is often, you know, spun pretty heavily. So you have to see with your own eyes what is going on in the ground so that you can report it out.
Thanks for that, Marisa. And we're going to hear more of that police response, and we'll hear from you more later in the program. We are using interviews this morning that aired on Your New Mexico Government last night. That's the show that Marisa DeMarco executive produces. That news-focused show has been covering the pandemic. And this week, it's focused entirely on race, police, and Black Lives Matter. You can tune in tonight and tomorrow night at 7 p.m. here on KUNM. So let's rewind a little bit to last Thursday night. After hours of peaceful demonstration by hundreds of people in Albuquerque's International District, four teenagers were pulled over by Albuquerque police. Two are Black, two are Latino. A few dozen protesters objected to their treatment by police as they're being taken into custody, activists tell us. And the boys were taken from the scene and released a couple hours later with no charges. Your NMGov host, Khalil Ekulona, spoke with one of those teenagers. Let's hear that conversation now.
So what brought you out to the protest on Thursday night?
I just want to support the movement just because I'm Hispanic, but I got some African-American people in my family. My niece is African-American. My brother-in-law is, and I got a lot of friends who are. So I just wanted to go and support the movement.
How many people went to the protest with you?
It was me, my little brother, who's 16, and his two friends who are African-American. One is 16 and one was 18.
So you guys are all just pretty young. What was the vibe of the night?
Yeah, everything was good. Like, we showed up around probably like 7 o'clock and everything was perfect. Around like 10 o'clock, that's like whenever things started to get a little bit amped up, but like it was nowhere near to what the protests were after that one. That one was peaceful, but we heard some gunshots, and that's like when we wanted to get out of there.
Yeah.
and we were driving away, and that's whenever we got pulled over by the cops a block away from Wyoming and Central, where the protest was.
Well, tell me, what was it like when you got pulled over by the cops?
Yeah, as soon as they pulled me over, they immediately asked me to turn off the car and to throw the keys out the window. So that's what I did. I was just scared, you know? They were slamming my little brother and his friends on the ground. They had guns to their face. They did the same thing to me, and I did ask them why I was being arrested, and they wouldn't tell me at all.
I know this is hard for you. What did that feel like?
Yeah, it was really scary just because they were yelling at my little brother's friend, who was 16 as well, telling them that they were going to shoot him. You know, and just with everything going on, I was really scared for them just because they're people of color. And, you know, I was just really scared for them. I was scared for myself. And it was just something scary, just having those guns pointed at your face for no reason.
So they were telling your little brother's friends that they were going to shoot them. This is while they're still down and the guns are pointed on them.
Yeah, yeah. They're telling them that they're going to shoot them. And they did tell my little brother to get up. And as soon as he got up, they body slammed him on the ground. And they gave him some bruises and stuff. And he did ask for medical attention later. And he's a minor, too. He's only 16. And mm-hmm. he's asking for medical attention later on. And they denied it.
About how many police officers were there?
There was probably around 10 police officers, and they looked like they were supposed to be in the army or something. They had big old guns, and yeah, I was just wondering why they needed all that just for a couple of teenagers.
Were you or anybody else, were you all put in cuffs?
Yeah, we were put in cuffs whenever all the protesters showed up and they came for our defense. That's when that happened. And as soon as they started showing up, that's when they pulled us off the ground and tried to act like nothing happened. My little brother and his friend, who are 16 years old, were asking to speak to the parents, and they said that they cannot do that. They weren't allowing them to.
Were you read your Miranda rights?
No, not until like 2 hours later. They put me in a car, drove me all the way to the station, and they didn't read my rights until a detective came like 2 hours later and talked to me.
How long did they hold you all?
Probably about 2-3 hours.
Did you get a vibe from these officers like they were mad at you, your little brother, and his friends for any specific reason?
Yeah, yeah. I got a vibe that they didn't like us at all, but they weren't telling us why they were doing all this. They just did it for no reason and treated us really badly. It seemed like a joke to them, like they were playing rock, paper, scissors on which one of us they got to question. It was like a whole game to them, it seemed like.
Mm-hmm. What was it like when you were released? Tell me that story.
Yeah, they just had me sitting there for hours, just not telling me at all what was going on. And I don't know where. I saw my brother. He got released back to my dad, and then his friend got released back to his parents as well. Mm-hmm. But with me, when they came and released me out of nowhere, and then I asked them where my personal belongings was, and they gave me my phone back, and it was cracked really bad. And then I was like, so you guys just gonna leave me out here with nothing? No, yeah, that's what we gonna do. They drove me farther into the war zone and just left me in the middle of the war zone with nothing at all, like 2 a.m. You know, I begged them. I was like, can you at least call somebody? Get me a ride or something. And oh, no, that's not a problem. And I asked where my little brother was, and oh, we don't know where he's at. And they just joked around about it, and they just thought it was funny. I just feel like, you know, they were just targeting us just because of our age, and they just looked at us as like vulnerable, you know, just our age, our race.
So APT takes possession of this car. When did you get the car?
Yeah, I just barely bought it on the 28th. I saved up for it with my own money, you know. You know, I was explaining that to them. I was like, can you guys just please like take care of it? Because it was so hard for me to get that car, and they were just joking around about it. Just left my keys in the middle of the war zone. Like, anybody can just go and take it.
Do you have any plans to go to any more demonstrations? Do you think you will after that experience?
No, I don't. It was just such a bad experience. You know, I went out there just to support, and I wasn't expecting, you know, all that to happen. I almost lost everything I worked for in one night for no reason.
Potentially a lot more with them threatening to shoot you all.
Yeah, yeah, they were threatening a lot of stuff. They're saying that, you know, they're trying to throw charges at me, just trying to get me to talk. They didn't have no evidence against me, but they were trying so hard to get me to talk. They like pretty much, it felt like they kidnapped me pretty much.
You're 18 years old. You got the rest of your life ahead of you. Talk to me about what type of impact do you think this is going to have on your life and what you do going forward.
I'm just going to feel like I can't call the cops for help, you know? Like, from what I saw, it seems like they don't want to help. I know there's some good cops out there, but the ones I saw that night, they weren't here to help me or help the community. From here on out, it's like, I feel like I can't trust them when I should, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is going to make me cautious all the time around them.
Yeah.
When I shouldn't have to, just because, you know, I just feel like I'm profiled now, especially now they know my car.
Is there a message you want to give to the chief of the APD and Mayor Keller?
Yeah, you know, they didn't have to do all that just for a couple teenagers, you know. We were just a couple kids just trying to, you know, just go fight for our rights, you know. And they didn't have to do all that to us, you know. Put us in an armored vehicle, have these guns pointed to our face with guys in bulletproof vests and goggles on and helmets and everything, you know. You know, that night, I didn't feel like I was human. I even told them, you know, treat me like a human, you know. That's how I definitely felt that night.
Yeah, I bet. I really want to thank you for being with me, my friend.
You're welcome. You know, thank you for calling and just letting me talk about this, too.
That was Noah Tapia, a teenager who was taken into custody after the Black Lives Matter march on Thursday last week. He spoke with Khalil Ikolona of your New Mexico government. For anyone listening, have you been at a protest in the last week or so? What was that like? Give us a call this morning, 277-5866. And our team noticed there seemed to be a difference in the way police responded to that Black Lives Matter protest versus their lack of visible presence at an anti-shutdown protest on Civic Plaza back in April. We followed up about that discrepancy with APD and the city at a couple of press conferences the morning after the protest. Here's reporter Marisa DeMarco with a summary of her questions and responses from APD Deputy Chief Harold Medina and then Mayor Tim Keller.
Demonstrators told us this morning that APD pulled out the armored car, the helicopter, two busloads of police and military tactical gear. Why use that level of force on a demonstration? And was the neighborhood that this took place in a consideration in how you decided to outfit police?
I think we need to really keep that in context, and we need to remember that we always are prepared for that kind of response. Riot officers, and one of the lessons learned from the Trump protest is we didn't have our officers outfitted in the proper gear, which allowed it to escalate to a point where our officers were endangered. Every single large protest, we have our officers prepared in that type of military gear, but we call it riot control gear, prepared to go out and respond if necessary and be safe. We also have to think of the safety of our officers. When that armored car was called in, it was called into a situation where we had officers being surrounded, dealing with individuals that we suspect could have fired several rounds in the area and could have done it several times during that time. So it isn't just one time that they fired rounds. We believe this vehicle fired rounds several times. So we are dealing with an armed subject, and we are dealing with it away from the crowd. So connecting the armored car to the crowd is kind of an unfair assessment, because that armored car was there to deal with the officers being surrounded at that vehicle that we take individuals into custody that were armed, that we're conducting a traffic stop. I hope that answers all your questions, but it wasn't handled any different because of this part of town than we do for any other mass gathering where we bring in resources.
I asked whether it turned out the people they took into custody were armed. Here's Medina.
We still don't have that information. That investigation is still being conducted, but we're still conducting that investigation to see if we're able to tie that vehicle. But early indications are we did have eyewitnesses who placed that vehicle as firing the shots, but we still need to confirm all that.
Then I asked if they had all the same gear ready to deploy for the anti-shutdown protests in Albuquerque in April that included at least six men armed with rifles.
No, we didn't have indications that that crowd was going to be as large as this crowd. We had indications as of yesterday that this crowd was going to approach 400 individuals. We never had that level or had that information that the protest here a couple weeks ago was going to reach that level.
I tried to ask about how when the tactical gear came out, there were only 50 or so protesters left from what we were hearing from demonstrators who were there. And the press conference was quickly ended. The International District is the neighborhood with the most African-American people in it in New Mexico, according to the census. I also asked Mayor Tim Keller about police response to the demonstrators there about an hour later on Friday.
So the question was, you know, was the racial background of an area equated to our response? And of course not. Our response is always calibrated to the number of people and the amount of danger and threat that there is. And it doesn't matter who's involved.
This is Let's Talk New Mexico. We're talking policing in Albuquerque. What do you think needs to change? You can give us a call, 277-5866. We need to go to a quick break now. I'm your host, Hannah Colton. We'll be back in a minute.
The Rothstein Donatelli Law Firm is committed to supporting KUNM, where the law firm's criminal practice can help clients petition state courts to permanently remove public records related to criminal charges and certain convictions. RothsteinLaw.com.
Support provided by Weekly Alibi, covering news, arts, and entertainment for Albuquerque since 1992. The friends at Weekly Alibi invite the community to help support local independent journalism when it's needed the most. Info at alibi.com/friends.
Gustavo Dudamel is grateful for the attention he gets as conductor and music director of the LA Philharmonic, but he's quick to point out he doesn't make the music himself.
He's not so personal, because at the end, it's a creation of the group, you know.
Dudamel and the LA Philharmonic in concert on the next Performance Today from APM.
Weekday mornings at 9 on KUNM.
Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico on KUNM. This morning, Black Lives Matter in Albuquerque. We're talking protests and police response. If you want to join the conversation, our phone lines are open. The number is 277-5866. Let's return for a few minutes to last Thursday night. One of the organizers of the demonstration in the International District that drew hundreds is Celinda Guerrero, a longtime organizer of around police violence and incarceration in New Mexico. She also organizes the mutual aid effort in Albuquerque during the pandemic. Celinda's husband was taken into custody on Monday. The violation order says he failed to report to his parole officer by curfew, was combative with police, and failed to report contact with police officers, which Celinda says happened the night of the protest. Here's her interview that Khalil Ecolona did. She explains what happened after the four teenagers were taken away from Central and Mesilla, and she and her husband saw that Noah Tapia's keys were left on the hood of his car.
So we had full intentions of finding the kids to make sure that they were okay. And so we took possession of the kids' property to protect it. When he got here, APD boxed him in, and they stole the car back from us. Hmm. My husband was in handcuffs in a different car. They drove off with him the other way to divert our attention, circled the block with him a few times, and then released him. Now we're Monday evening, and the next Black Lives Matter protest is about to engage. They've been following us and surveilling us all week. So we're on Gibson. They circle our vehicle, and they take Clifton to MDC. And they classify him STG Reds, which means segregation. It's like a lockdown. And then the booking clerk says, why are you here? There's nothing in the system. And he told her, I don't even know why I'm here. They called the arresting officers back, who then hand wrote a warrant in front of my husband for a curfew violation related to the night that the APD stole the car from us. My husband, when he came home from prison, he had a night job and he never had the curfew parameter in his conditions of parole. So now we've learned they have remanufactured a new warrant that now the allegation is that he was at a liquor store.
Do you feel like this is retaliation?
It's absolutely retaliation. He's had a positive interaction with his PO just on Wednesday when his PO told him, keep doing what you're doing fantastic, all positive reports. And then he starts organizing for Black Lives Matter on Thursday, and now all of a sudden, there's parole violations. Throughout this entire period, his PO hasn't had any contact with him to give him indications that he shouldn't have been doing any of these things.
Clifton's incarcerated at a time where COVID-19 is spreading through prisons and jails, and it's a huge concern. A nonviolent parole violation during a time when officials are saying the goal is to get nonviolent offenders out to prevent an outbreak. Have you gotten a chance to talk to him? Is he worried about getting the virus at all?
He is. There's an outbreak in Torrance County right now in the county pod where they have the misdemeanor holding. Prisoners just this week had to riot in there to get them to get medical attention to a man in the pod who hadn't eaten for days. And this is happening behind the walls, and he knows this, and he supports these efforts of Freedom All Friday. And so because of his work, he's being retaliated against. And this is what it looks like to be a political prisoner.
People probably don't understand the history of policing, particularly in the International District. Last summer, we had the State Police Metro Surge operation targeting the area. Then there was the Sheriff's Department's crackdown right after that. A couple years before, it was an ATF sting. What does this all feel like for residents?
All of these things happen every single day in our neighborhood. We have federal police right now active in the Southeast under relentless pursuit. They invested $71 million to attack the seven cities, and we're one of the seven cities. We have state police, Bernalillo County sheriffs, who don't even wear lapels or dash cams. We have APD, and they activate federal CIs against us, paid informants setting us up. When somebody gets pulled over three times, two times on the way to the grocery store and one time on the way back, we are extremely over-policed.
What do you want to see happen today or this week on these issues? What's most pressing?
Well, we're working. We have a whole campaign right now to free Clifton. And folks should understand and know. I know that this is all complicated legal jargon for some folks. So he doesn't have an active court case, and he does not have probation. So there's no jurisdiction in any court system for him. It's completely separate. Parole is administrative only in the Department of Corrections. And the state of New Mexico has for years been using illegal parole sentences to enhance people's sentences. And there's no relief anywhere for it because it's administrative, your state property. So only the governor has authority over you because they own you. This is one of the states that does not allow for legal representation during a parole retake, a parole hearing. And they do it completely in secret. They meet with prisoners on a small video screen. People are not allowed to come in and testify or observe. And Clifton has now had seven parole terms on the very same case number that dates back to when he was 18 years old in 2001. He does not have new crimes this decade. All of the prison time that he's done this decade have been technical parole and probation violations. And right now he's on an illegal parole period. And we wrote the governor objecting to the parole period since September. And she's refused to acknowledge us. If folks can keep making calls to the governor, she could release him this minute. She has the full authority, because it's administrative, to release him this minute. Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham's phone number is 505-476-2200.
Thank you so much, Celinda.
Thanks, Khalil.
You're listening to Let's Talk New Mexico. I want to take a call from Pedro in Española. Good morning, Pedro. Thanks for calling in.
Good morning.
What would you like to add?
Good morning. I've been desperately trying for, you know, going on 4 years now with my crusade. It's crusadeforaid.org, but we marched on both governors. I've been doing this maybe on two administrations, maybe three, on a lot of our problems around here. All three administrations, I've approached them and told them, I believe a big problem we have is we have problems within the state level and the ethics boards and the ethics committees and law enforcement. We have a lot of problems within the committees up in the State Board of Education. I mean, we're failing in all our schools. I put a lot of this blame on the top level administration, not only at state level, but within districts and within law enforcement, because a lot of these law enforcement, you know, I see it around here. They get fired from state police. Then they get unethical charges. And then they get rehired for the sheriff's department. They do the same thing. They get fired there again for the same behaviors. Then they get hired for the city police. And then they're fired for the same reason. And then they get hired for the tribal police. So a lot of these individuals are just getting tossed over without the top ethics boards and committees pulling their licensure. I believe that they should implement a strike 3 year out rule on them. You know, not only them, but administrators in schools, because, I mean, what's good for the goose, good for the gander. It happens with the people in the streets with the strike 3 rule. Well, we need to implement one with them, because if they continually fail us, I think they need to find a new occupation. They need to get a new job, because that's not right. That is totally, totally not right. I think, and I've told Grisham, I told Martinez, I told them the problems are at the top level, because everybody focuses on the crime on the streets and with our people. But right. We have a lot of crime within, white collar criminals within, and that needs to be addressed like big time, because people are dying here. And I'm fed up with it. They've turned all our youth into informants and snitches, and it's a sad sad thing that most of these kids can't even get jobs, and they have to hide inside their home because they don't want to be seen out in public. They're out in the night like vampires because they say, oh, they're afraid that somebody's going to say, oh, there goes that guy, he's snitching. And, you know, it's an injustice, and they're killing off our youth, and I'm fed up with it, you know. And I'm sure I'm not the only one, but if we don't start taking a stand in our own neighborhoods to try to push this drug element away and those that are bringing it in, then we're going to lose this battle.
Pedro, thank you so much for calling in from Española. That is really troubling. And thanks for all those thoughts. Another caller is on the line from Rio Rancho. Chris, welcome to the program.
Hi. You know, I've been observing these things for many years. And I have to say that in all cultures, there are bullies. And too many of these bullies are police. They are bullies with badges. And in many cases, if they don't or can't qualify as police, they become corrections officials or officers. What we need is a much more rigorous screening and testing of police and corrections officers to get rid of the bullies. And also, as the previous caller mentioned, we need to start early in the schools. There have been efforts to prevent bullying in schools, and we need to start there to prevent these bullies with badges who, and this is male, female, all cultures, prevent the bullies from getting in power.
I hear you. Chris, thanks so much for your call this morning. I want to bring into the program Baron Jones, who's a senior policy analyst at the ACLU of New Mexico and a member of the APD Forward Coalition. Good morning, Baron.
Good morning, Hannah. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being with us. Lot of things coming up this morning. What's kind of top of mind for you as you listen to Noah earlier in the program, Celinda, Pedro with his experiences with police in Española? What's coming up first?
I guess, you know, we need to sort of really come up with some sort of plan to lessen the contact with police and the public. And there's a lot of talk nationwide now. The ACLU National is going to sign on to the divestment, Black Lives Matter divestment letter. And the hopes is one day we can start working toward lessening that contact with law enforcement and changing how law enforcement respond to calls and calls without law enforcement. You get what I'm saying? So we can sort of work to, have a police less state towards that.
And when you say divestment, is that the same as the calls to defund that we've been hearing?
Yeah. Defund police, and just sort of reroute how we use some of that money.
I was reading yesterday that Los Angeles is looking at cutting their police department budget by up to $150 million, which a lot of money. That's 8% of their budget. What kinds of things would you rather that money be spent on?
You know, treatment and training programs that sort of, and it's really too early to sort of envision it because the concept is just arising. So I don't want to, you know, get too far out there. But any sort of measures that would change how we respond to crisis. You know, in some places they're implementing
programs that have social workers respond to folks who are having, you know, social workers and mental health professionals responding to situations where it's a mental health crisis or things like that. But I don't want to get too far out because this the concept is just sort of starting to settle in.
Yeah, it seems like a thing that maybe similar to other maybe social policies we've seen pushed during the pandemic. It's like it's feeling like something that maybe was too radical for a lot of people a few months ago, but maybe a lot more people are looking at seriously. Do you have that sense right now?
Yeah. And especially with the what we're seeing here, you know, with the sort of the uprising and the protests throughout the nation is folks responding to years and years and decades of police brutality, you know, waged on communities across the U.S. And so, so people realize that with that policing comes immense power, and one way to sort of check that power is through the budget process. That conversation is moving in many circles. But here in Albuquerque, you know, we're sort of ahead of the game. We have the court approved settlement agreement, which sort of guides policing in Albuquerque, and we're seeing some good things, but there are also some much needed improvements that should take place.
Right. So APD Forward, the coalition, is a group of people, organizations looking to ensure that the APD does implement those reforms that have been court ordered. What kinds of reforms are you most keeping an eye on or wanting to see progress on right now?
Primarily, you know, things like use of force, the use of force policies. You know, the APD Forward sort of came into being following a rash of police shootings, 2011, 12, and 13, that culminated with the death of murder of James Boyd and the Foothills. And, right. And the coalition sort of formed not too long after that. And with a keen eye on looking at police, the use of force policies, the data collection policies, things that sort of speak to how law enforcement, AP Albuquerque Police Department, is interacting with the communities across the city.
And we got a comment from Alan of Albuquerque, who says the Albuquerque Police Officers Association, the union, APOA, has consistently blocked reform, as the federal court monitor noted. Alan says a few years ago, APOA elected as its vice president an officer whom the DOJ described as standing over an unarmed, unmoving teenager and shooting him in the chest at point blank range. The union president said it was invaluable that officers would be represented by someone with an intimate acquaintance with the use of force. I obviously haven't fact checked any of that myself, but Baron, what do you think about the involvement of the police union and the union leadership and how they've responded to this court ordered agreement?
Well, you know, what we do know is that there is an element within the department that sort of has been described by the monitor as the counter CASA effect. And what that is officers and line supervisors sort of delaying.
Lack of accountability,
Yeah, accountability. Thank you. Accountability. So there's issues with accountability and officers and supervisors pushing forward use of force complaints and properly investigating them. So what we're seeing is that time is lapsing where there's no real awareness, too late to implement, you know, either some sort of progressive discipline or accountability measures that will sort of correct the behavior, you know. And so we're seeing a lot of that within the department.
I see. For anyone listening, are you angry about right now when it comes to police and violence? What are you angry about? How are you directing that anger? You can give us a call this morning, 277-5866. We need to go to a break now. I'm Hannah Colton. You're listening to Let's Talk New Mexico on KUNM.
UNM Health believes now more than ever is the time to focus on individual and community health. Stay home, minimize risks, and remember to help protect the vulnerable within the community. UNM Health proudly serves the community and proudly supports KUNM.
Relationships are the key to keeping people healthy. That's an idea that informs a healthcare system serving 65,000 Alaska Native and Native American people in Alaska. On the next Native America Calling, we'll talk with experts from this health system about how they prepared for the COVID-19 crisis. We hope you can join us.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA, the East LA walkouts. We bring you a story of student activism from 1968 when thousands of students walked out of their high school and helped spark the Chicano movement.
We were being treated differently. It was wrong.
That's next time on Latino USA.
That's Latino USA, Monday mornings at 8 a.m. on KUNM.
Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm your host, Hannah Colton. We're talking about police violence in Albuquerque and what needs to change to ensure justice and safety for Black and brown people here in New Mexico. What has this week of unrest and uprising been like for you? Do you fear police? Why or why not? There's still time to call in this morning. It's 277-5866. I want to talk about Monday night a little bit. During and after that protest, armed militiamen showed up throughout the protest in the UNM area in Albuquerque. They were wearing military tactical gear, carrying assault-style weapons. These men said they were from the New Mexico Civil Guard, a militia that's been forming around the state, and we have indications that many of them might be from out of town, even out of state. And police did not intervene as those, you know, mostly white men walked around heavily armed, even after a shot was fired, which really stood out to us in contrast to last Thursday when riot police were, you know, throwing four Black and brown teenage protesters on the ground, hauling them off after shots were fired. Remember, there were no firearms found on the scene and they did not charge those boys with anything. Baron, I want to ask you, what do you make of that difference that we're perceiving in the way that police respond to potential threats of violence at these actions?
Well, you know, I'm not too familiar with what happened Monday night, but I do know this. What we do know historically is that in Black and brown communities and Black bodies and brown bodies are racialized at a rate far, far more than white folks here in the U.S. And that sort of creates this over-policing effect and this perceived danger. So, you know, we see law enforcement. We've seen it throughout the nation, you know, law enforcement walking side by side with armed, you know, white folks and camouflage. But, you know, when Black people and brown people pick up arms, is often seen as a threat, as opposed to partnership, as we see sometimes when white folks have those done.
Right. Marisa DeMarco, KUNM reporter, is on the line here. Any additional thoughts about that difference in police response? You know, shots fired, heard in the area of the protest in each case, and what's the perception of the threat? How are you thinking about that, Marisa?
Yeah, so, I mean, it really did stand out to me that on Thursday night during the demonstration, there's shots fired, police aren't sure, you know, where those come from. They put these teens on the ground. Two of them are Black, two of them are Chicano. Take them into custody, have this whole situation. And then on Monday night, shots are fired again, and there are a lot of guys walking around with these rifles. I mean, we were hearing on the scanner, like, a van pulls up and the doors open and, like, a whole bunch of militia dudes pop out with their rifles.
Right.
So it's interesting that in one case you have folks with those rifles out in the open, you hear shots and none of them are taken in, and then in the other case you have shots and, you know, these teens are taken in. And, you know, they're different areas of town, too. Like, in one area of town, we're talking about, I think it was Yale, the Yale University area. That's on Monday night when nobody was taken into custody after shots were fired. And then on Thursday, the previous Thursday, you're talking about the International District, which is, you know, has much different demographics than anywhere else in the state, right? So, yeah, I think there's a lot of considerations about how and where police perceive danger and by whom in Albuquerque and in these protests.
And we heard from Celinda Guerrero earlier about over-policing in that area in the International District. And it's an area with a lot of African-American people, a lot of migrants and refugees. And Baron, you were just talking about, you know, the difference in perception where people of color are considered a threat. But should we be surprised about this history of over-policing, given the origins of police in America? I mean, I'm talking about origins of police as slave catchers and colonial border enforcers.
Yeah, for sure. You know, we sort of shouldn't be surprised. And I've been dealing with it all my life, right? And so when we see things like this, before I was 12 years old, I probably seen police kill black men on two separate occasions. And what we're seeing here in Albuquerque and across the nation is that people are just really sort of sick of that unchecked violence and that over-policing. It's no, you know, when we look at incarceration figures in the state, it's no secret that black men and brown folks are incarcerated at a much higher rate, and that's the direct result of that over policing. And so it creates a cycle. That makes it hard for folks to, you know, move around with their lives, and the end result is that we get a communities that are just 100% fed up, and they're tired of being abused by racist police system. And as you mentioned, I guess, you know, police violence and over-policing has been a mainstay ever since the concept of police reform, you know, a couple hundred years ago. And now, you know, with the city of Albuquerque, you know, we're sort of ahead of the game, you know, with this court-approved settlement agreement. And if we, you know, sort of monitor the police and monitor their progress and how they use of force, we can go a long way to sort of ending that, making sure that when officers are found to have violated department policies, that they're discipline, unlike what we're seeing now, a total failure to discipline. We need to make sure that, this court-approved settlement agreement was, you know, came through after, you know, very, very thoughtful work was put into it, right? And if these measures are, you know, implemented in accordance with the settlement agreement, we will probably, you know, see a lot of this stuff sort of starts to subside, because the police department will be a little bit more efficient and use their resources, and we'll get rid of things like the counter CASA effect, where officers are, officers and supervisors, for that matter. You know, I mean, the counter CASA effect, the monitor found that it ran all the way up to the command structure. So it's a huge problem. But as folks, city, as community members, you know, we need to sort of be more involved and hold law enforcement and leadership accountable to how they police our communities.
And we've been talking about the International District, so I want to mention, too, that that's also an area with many Native Americans, and we know that Indigenous people experience a disproportionate rate of police violence comparable to what African Americans experience as well. And Marisa DeMarco on the line, can you give us some information about over-policing in the International District? I know you've done a lot of reporting, and there was a lot going on last summer.
Yeah, so just last summer, there was, you know, a lot of killings all around Albuquerque. And after one in which a UNM student athlete was killed in Nob Hill, the governor ordered the state police, 50 state police officers, to come to Albuquerque to boost patrols on the promise of stopping violence. And that was called Operation Metro Surge. They focused their efforts largely on the south side of town from looking at their police reports and very much on the International District. They, of course, are not bound by obligations of the CASA or the settlement agreement that APD is in the same way. And so it was, you know, I went to the International District. You did see lots of police cars all over the neighborhood. And we heard all kinds of stories from residents about what that feels like. And that was just kind of one moment in time. A couple years before, you have the ATF, which is a federal agency, initiating a sting operation in the International District. And then last summer, again, right after the Metro Surge concluded, there was a Bernalillo County Sheriff's Office sting on the International District. This is just something that is repeatedly happening to that particular neighborhood repeatedly by various law enforcement agencies, right? And so not all of it ends up being within APD's jurisdiction or subject to their goals of community-based policing. The politicians like Michelle Lujan Grisham and Mayor Tim Keller do bring in other law enforcement agencies, and they're often cracking down on that area.
Okay. We have a caller from Albuquerque. Bob, you are on the air. What would you like to add?
Well, what I would like to do is let's step back on the previous segment where we talked about the four young men in the car that
sure.
were arrested and were taken into custody. The police action was reprehensible. I agree with that. That was poorly executed. But let's connect some dots between what Chief Medina said. You know, that car and those young men were reported to have fired shots, and the police were reacting. And then, bless their hearts, Celinda and her husband were trying to recover that car for the young man, but they were interfering in what was perceived at the time to be a crime scene. So,
yeah, so a little more context. I can provide that, Bob, because obviously we didn't have time to get into all of the details. Those teenagers do tell us that they didn't have anything to do with guns that night. They weren't firing from their car. They had just been leaving the protest. Police did not recover any weapons on the scene. They told us the next day that they were getting a search warrant and investigating. And they didn't file any charges, which, you know, brings up a lot of questions for us about if you're going to bring some people in, not file any charges. They also said that they didn't have any other suspects. So we have a lot of questions about whether the police have any evidence at all that those teenagers were involved. And as to your other point about the car, the property, you know, there is a process for police to, you know, confiscate property, and it involves, you know, calling in the crime scene investigation. And Celinda and her husband are telling us that none of those processes were followed. So I hope that provides a little more additional context, but we do have more reporting about that on our website. Thanks, Bob. I want to get, before we are getting to the end of the program, I want to get to, you know, a big roadblock that we have in wrapping our heads around race and policing in New Mexico, and that is a complete lack of racial and ethnic data in the state that the state and agencies keep. So here's criminal justice reporter Jeff Proctor speaking with Marisa DeMarco about that. He says that racial data does not get tracked for people in any part of the criminal justice system in New Mexico.
From informal contacts with law enforcement officers to traffic stops to actual arrests to who's in the 30 county jails around the state to who's in the state's prisons, we don't know data-wise the race and ethnicity of any of those people. So it leaves the state and all of its law enforcement agencies in a position where it simply can't answer questions about whether non-white people are being discriminated against.
How does this these translate to a bigger picture? If the criminal justice system in New Mexico isn't tracking race and ethnicity data, what else don't we know?
There's a bottomless ocean of what we don't know. But in terms of like what the consequences are of this, it leaves policymakers like state legislators and governors and mayors and county commissioners in a place where they can't make evidence-based policies about how people are treated in jail, how people are treated in prison, where police resources are deployed, whether officers need additional training, sort of anti-bias type training. So it leaves policymakers in a terrible position.
What are some of the arguments about why collecting this information is complicated here?
There just aren't very many good arguments completely and totally against it, but it is complicated in New Mexico. There are all kinds of people in New Mexico who identify with more than one race or ethnicity, people who identify as Hispanic and Native American, for example. But in terms of arguments against government agencies and actors in the criminal justice system, don't ask questions they don't want the answers to.
We've got just about a minute left here. Barron Jones is on the line with the ACLU and APD Forward. Barron, I wanted to ask, is that lack of racial data for arrests and incarceration, is that something you're concerned about in your work?
Yes, and it's something that we've been advocating for at APD Ford. You know, we think the Albuquerque Police Department is sort of getting things together a little bit. But yes, that's something that's very important for our work. Just for the reasons Jeff Plato described. So we can see, the policy makers and lawmakers can use that information to craft evidence-based policies and police in a different way police in a more holistic way with all those factors taken into account. And just overall, I would like to say once again, APD Ford and on our web site, apdford.org, I believe it is. I'll pull it up here. But we can, the public can go there and track, and they have all those. We have all the monitors report, and we'll make sure we have the independent monitors 11 report published on that site, so folks can comb through it and sort of read how the department is doing.
Thank you so much, Barron Jones. So that's APD Forward. You can Google it. We are out of time. Thank you so much to our guests, Noah Tapia, Celindo Guerrero, and Barron Jones. These are heavy topics. We know getting into them when it's your personal life is emotional work, and those efforts are not unnoticed. Thanks also to KUNM's Marisa DeMarco and Khalil Ikolona for their hard work putting together the show last night that we jumped off of today. Tune into Your NM Government Wednesdays through Fridays at its new time of 7 p.m. or listen whenever, wherever on your podcast app. If you missed part of today's show or want to share it with friends, find the show page on KUNM.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Let's Talk New Mexico on your podcast app of choice. Thank you, as always, to our engineer, Marino Spencer. Megan Kamrick live-tweeted the show. Kavi Moahead screened your calls. Ty Bannerman produced today's show. I'm Hannah Colton. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on KUNM.